I can't tell people that I've got four children. We all know that it's hard, but being constantly told that is not always helpful. We had the recession, going to Google, that not working out. I did set up another business with someone and that didn't work out. My husband lost his job twice and had had an accident before that. And then we had COVID and like I literally was like a shadow of my former self.
Jesus.
So I basically had a bit of a breakdown. Finally, I sort of got my mindset sorted, started investing in Asian female founders, set up female founders right. So I kind of like changed everything.
What are some of the privileges that you recognise that have helped you get to where you are today?
If you can run a long-term, profitable, sustainable business, that does enable more money to go into the hands of women. There's always meant to be one fund returner and it's going to be a female founder. Most guys that are raising investment have got the message that it's easier for white men.
Emmy Faust is a 3-times exited entrepreneur turned angel investor and now founder of Female Founders Rise, the supportive and inspiring resource for female founders to help them succeed with their businesses. Emmy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I purposely left out an important detail in your bio. Can you guess what it is?
Oh my gosh, I don't know if I was listening to it well enough.
It's always cringe listening to your
own
intros.
Mum of four.
That's the one.
That's the bit I always start with.
I heard you say that you always start with that detail on your intro. So why do you think it's so important to put that front and centre?
I think I just like to say that up front because that's probably one of the most important parts of my life. Definitely is. I also feel like maybe, not that it explains things, but it's important for me. So I think it's important for other people to know. And I think when I was doing my consultancy, I actually hid the fact that I had four children because I felt like my clients might think, oh, you know, she's not going to be capable because she's got four children. She's going to be so busy. I also thought, and I did have a few conversations that I got the impression this is what people thought, oh, you're a mum, you're just doing this little bit of fun on the side. Oh, you charge that much, that's very expensive. You know, aren't you just doing a little passion project? So when I was doing my consultancy, I remember actually feeling like I can't tell people that I've got four children because that will definitely go against my pricing and against them believing in my ability, whether they think that or not. Is another matter. And then I think now I'm doing my own thing, I can just like be proud of who I am. And also I've just found my voice and realised that, you know, it's important to speak the truth and it's important for people to know that. And actually that connects me with a lot of people because they can see that you can be a mum and have children and be a founder. And yeah, it's full on.
So do you feel, I'm sure it is, and I definitely want to ask how you do it all, which, you know, with everything you've got going on and four kids, I'm sure everyone is wondering how on earth you do it. But it's interesting to hear, do you feel that you kind of, you've reached this point in your career where you've got enough confidence to share the fact that you're a mum of four? Or do you think that there's more of a movement now where people can embrace more of that authenticity? Obviously, you've got a big following online as well, and that authentic voice that you definitely have shines through.
I think it's a mix. I think it's really important to obviously be authentic and be yourself, and it can be really difficult to do that when you're doing your own thing and you don't have stakeholders and potential clients. And I feel like I can say what I want and there's not going to be any comeback. And if there is, then I don't care about being associated with those people anyway. But I remember when I had clients, you know, I would feel like I couldn't talk about my mental health and say that I was struggling or that I'd had a wobble because I'd be thinking, well, what are they going to think about me? They're not going to think I'm capable. And so I do think, and often I get DMs from people who might be trying to raise investment or they might be working in a business and they say, what you said really resonated, but I actually can't share those things because if I do, I'm not seen to be capable. So I think I'm in this position now where I can, you know, share how I feel and share what I want to share. And I've got that. It's an amazing privilege to be able to do that. I think when you're working for someone, you maybe don't, or you need the clients or you need the money from investors, you can't be telling people like the truth of what's really going on out there.
Those anxieties, I think, are so valid. And I think so many of our listeners would resonate with that, especially mums. I'm hearing a lot of these stories as well, the worry of what other people think, especially if it's clients, as you say. I mean, what was your process? Because I read about you kind of going on a bit of a journey yourself through, you know, you have had your success, so it does make it easier to be more vocal about these, you're a mum of four and everything else, but was there anything else that helped you kind of find that confidence and be able to be authentic?
I think, you know, I was successful when I was quite young. So we set up our business when we were 25 and we sold, we had various businesses, some successful, some failures. Actually, the failure was like a real, you know, I never told anyone about that. We went on Dragon's Den. I'm confident to talk about it now, but at the time I didn't because I felt like it was a failure. And that business failed on Dragon's Den. And I sold my business, and even though I'd been really successful and made quite a lot of money, not huge amounts, but, you know, enough to be able to angel invest and do, you know, do great things, I didn't tell anyone about all of those things. So, like, none of my children's friends' parents would have, you know, my new friends would have known about my past. Like, they didn't know I'd been on Dragon's Den. They didn't know I'd had successful businesses. I just kept it all very quiet. And I remember when I sold my business, I had a very short stint at Google, which didn't last because I realized I was never going to see my family. And then whilst I was there in that 6 weeks, we sold another one of our businesses. So I didn't need to desperately work at that point. And so my stint at Google didn't work. Then I basically decided I'd do consultancy, but I didn't really, I wanted to work because I love working, but I didn't really know what to do, which sounds silly, but do I do business growth? Do I do consultancy for marketing because I'd run a media agency? I've been like a sort of, you know, you do a bit of everything when you run a business, you know, because you've run a marketing agency. You do the new business, you look after the team, you're doing maybe some of the work, you're doing, I was like really into all the finance, I was trading currencies because we were buying media across multiple territories. So I didn't have this kind of like expertise where I could be like, I'm a SEO guru or I'm a whatever. And I remember at one point I had one client that was half a day a month or something. They were paying me 500 quid a month. And I just thought, I'm getting paid 500 quid a month. I've got all this incredible insight. What is going wrong? Like, why am I not got loads of clients? But I really didn't have any confidence because I hadn't ever told myself when I sold my business that I'd done amazingly well. And there weren't, it's much more congratulatory, is that the right word, now? Mm-hmm. Like, people are much more, like, celebrating things. I remember everyone just saying, just be really humble, whatever. You're brought up to be humble. So didn't, you know, didn't sort of celebrate that. And then I had a call with this mindset coach, and I was like, I just haven't got any clients. And I just, and he was like, well, why aren't you telling everyone about, like, what you did? And I was like, oh, you know, can't do that kind of thing. That's really embarrassing. Why don't you tell everyone about the successes you've had? Because actually, if you don't tell them, they won't know you can help them. And that really, like, flicked a switch, because I was like, I want to help people. I want to try and share all the things I've learned. And actually, by being quiet and not telling people what I'd done, I was just expecting people to know. I was kind of waiting for people to be like, oh, Emmy, you're amazing. Can you come and help us? Without actually telling them that I could do that. So that was really interesting. He really helped me change my mindset. And also he was like, you must tell everyone about going on Dragon's Den. That's amazing. The fact that you got onto Dragon's Den, the fact you got accepted by Google, even though, you know, because the fact that I went to work at Google and then it didn't work out, that was another massive knock to my confidence, because it wasn't them, it was me. I said, I can't stay here. But I'd made this such big thing in my head about getting a job there, and it was going to be my ideal job, and I was going to be so happy, and it was like, you know, the best job for someone working in digital and tech, this big brand. And then I felt really embarrassed that I hadn't managed to, like, see it through. And people would be like, how's your job at Google going? And you're sort of like, oh, it hasn't worked out. And I don't know, I just felt like though that kind of really knocked my confidence. Also, when you have babies, maybe I'm not speaking for everyone, but speaking for a lot of people I know, when you have babies, it does knock your confidence because you're like out of the work scene. And then you sort of go back and you feel like you've been out of it and you've like maybe lost some of your connections, or you've forgotten, or things have moved on, and you're suddenly like feeling like, oh, I'm back in this place as a different person because I've got a child, you know, and all these different things going on in your head, and you just lose your confidence. So I think actually after selling my business, I definitely wasn't confident.
That's such a surprise to hear, because you come across as someone who's so confident.
I feel like I found it again.
You found it now, yeah. But obviously you've grown through what you've gone through is what it seems like. And it's such an important message to share, and just having you as a role model to other women, because even as I'm listening to you, I can think of individuals that I know firsthand who've gone through exactly what you've gone through. This is a story we hear over and over. Very briefly on the subject of role models, I feel like there's so many other things I want to ask you, but I heard about you having a female role model quite early on in your career, a lady called Anna.
Yeah, that's amazing. We actually used to work around here.
What a coincidence.
Yeah, very close to here.
Do you feel like the amount of female role models has changed now? Do you feel like women have more, less, or the same women to look up to now?
I was talking about this earlier with someone about having role models. You know, like, we've got to be able to see these women from all backgrounds, all sectors, all verticals, all ages doing amazing things so that we can, you know, we can see that it's possible. If I look back, I think it was quite unusual, because also the other interesting thing was that her husband worked for her. So she was like in charge. She was pregnant and would bring her baby into work and would just like leave it on the floor in a little, you know, fur rug. She was nails running a very successful, very profitable business. And her husband was behind the scenes, and he used to come and do all the finances and the accounting and stuff, which was kind of like at the time, like the other way around. It would normally be like the women doing all the, you know, the PAYE and the stuff like that. So I think she really did inspire me. But obviously at the time, I didn't realise that. And I remember telling her that I was going to set up a business like hers. And she, it's a bit of a weird thing, isn't it, to tell your boss? And she said something like, oh, no, you're not, you know, you're not Emmy, you wouldn't. But basically she was saying something along the lines of like, that you'd actually be bored doing this. You know, you need to do something else. And I probably would have been bored doing what she did, but she was very successful. And the thing that I learned from her, she treated us so well. So she paid us really well. Whenever we used to go away, she used to put us up in these amazing hotels, like hotels that aren't actually so amazing anymore, but at the time were like, you know, the five star, like the coolest hotels. And the reason that I know this area, because we're in Shoreditch now, is her first office was here. She bought an office here actually ages ago. And she used to take us out to these really cool restaurants that we'd never be able to, you know, we were like in our 20s, so we'd never be able to afford to go there. And we used to go for really nice dinners and have amazing cocktails. And like, I was just like, wow, you know, this woman's amazing.
And so now today for women, do you feel like that number has grown across?
I think there are. I just think they were way more visible. I think maybe those women were there, but we weren't aware of them because, you know, we weren't on social media then. This was like, I don't know, I'm 45 now. So this must have been over 20 years ago. We didn't have any of that kind of thing. Mm. So it really was just like, do you know someone who you're working for? I don't remember there being anyone else, but
you were super lucky to have that experience.
I was.
Yeah, she sounds amazing. I want to meet her.
I did actually track her down on LinkedIn, I think, recently when someone had asked me, and I was just like, I just want to let you know that, you know, you're amazing.
Yeah, amazing. And you touched on Dragon's Den as well, which is something else I wanted to briefly ask you. We're going to get into female founders rise, your exit, angel investing. Those are some big topics that I want to try and make some time for as well. But just because you were talking about Dragon's Den before, this is probably a coincidence, but you are now my third guest on the show who's been on Dragon's Den, and just so happen all three of them have all been women. So again, it's probably a coincidence, but I wonder whether there is, now that you are the third female guest that I'm interviewing who's been on Dragon's Den, you know, of course I'm wondering, is there something there? I wonder whether it's almost, you know, easier to go on Dragon's Den and pitch, even though it's a 4-hour, it's a grueling process, but does that seem more attractive to women than going to VCs? I don't know, but it's just...
I don't know, because I think with Dragon's Den, for us, it was 20 years ago. We went on 18 years ago, so it was a totally different program to how it is now. I think now they often go and source founders and businesses to go on based on, you know, they probably want to have a good mix of business types and people and all that kind of stuff. At the time, it was really new, Dragon's Den, and I just thought it might all be a bit made up. So I just applied on a whim. And actually, the business that I applied for wasn't making any money and wasn't doing anything. And I literally just remember doing it as a bit of a joke. And I put in that we wanted 300 grand and we were valuing the business. We wanted 200 grand and we were valuing the business at 2 million or something like that. I mean, I didn't even know how to do valuations. This was just like a total piss take. And then for some reason, we got on. We had an interview and we got on, and then I was like, I need to make this business that has never made any money, that's like 6 months old, be valued at £2 million. How do I do that? And my background is actually, so I did economics, accounting and law at uni, so like numbers is like my forte. So I managed to create these complicated equations, which I also managed to remember, and they didn't show this in the thing, but like I just flipped the whiteboard over and I was like, do you want to see how I got here? And it came out as £2 million, and they were like, oh, okay. And we got the funding, but they actually gave us 200 grand for 30%. So I said, wow, 200 grand for 10%.
Yeah.
So at the time, it was the biggest single investment ever. Mm. I also dragged my business partner on there, but he really didn't want to go on Dragon's Den. Mm. And he was totally not up for it at all. And it was kind of my little project that I'd... It's kind of a long story, but anyway, he definitely wasn't up for it. I was up for it for, like, initially just to sort of scope out, is this thing real? And then we got funding.
Not only did you get funding, but you obviously made history by getting the biggest amount at that
point. I think since then there's obviously been people that got more, but...
Up until that point anyway. From the outside looking in, it almost seems as though, linking back a little bit to the confidence theme, which might be a recurring topic as we continue the conversation, but it almost seems as though your confidence has kind of gone on a bit of a U-shape in terms of this high confidence at the start of your career. You had this female CEO, this boss you kind of looked up to, you had that confidence to go on Dragon's Den and sell a business, even though it wasn't revenue generating.
Amazing.
You had all that amazing stuff, and then it almost, from the sounds of it, kind of dipped with some of the failures, the Google experience, maybe the kids, and now it's kind of like you're going back up and finding it again.
Yeah, I think running a business is very wearing, tiring, as we know. And so that was like right at the beginning when I was 25, like, oh, you know, we're invincible, we can do anything. And then we had the recession in 2008, and then, you know, your team end up leaving and going to someone else, and it's like, feels hard, you know, and you have all these things, and it's like constantly being sort of slightly worn down. And then you add children into the mix, and, you know, some of my children slept really well and some didn't. And then you add in, you know, various other things. Going to Google, that not working out. And then also after that, I did set up another business with someone and that didn't work out. That was like another knock to the thing. And then actually I did my consultancy for a long time. And I obviously, then I had that session with the mindset guy, and finally I sort of got my mindset sorted, but still I wasn't doing what I loved. I think the last year and 3 months has been when I found my voice and found my confidence, because to cut a very long story short, I was ill for about a year and a half, mentally and physically, just had all these things going wrong with me all the time. And so I basically had a bit of a breakdown, and I had long COVID and a whole, and the perimenopause, like a mix of everything all came together. I moved my family to Wales. That didn't work out. I moved them all back. So moving 4 children, like schools there and schools back, and my husband lost his job twice and had had an accident before that. And then we had COVID, and like, I literally was like a shadow of my former self.
Jesus.
Unable to do anything really, actually, like not even go to like a dinner party or go to a client meeting. I'd be having like a sort of a panic attack. I didn't realize it was a panic attack at the time.
Wow.
And then finally not the summer we just had. So now like 18 months ago, I finally found a doctor who helped me and made lots of changes. I did a post about this actually on LinkedIn yesterday. Made lots of changes to my life and started therapy, anti-anxiety meds, stopped doing my consultancy, sold my house in Wales that I'd bought when I sold my business, started investing in 8 female founders, which has been amazing for my life, my brain, my like, you know, energy, set up female founders wise. So I kind of like changed everything. And that I've slowly got better, and I've kind of come out the other side, and I'm now doing my what I love. You know, this is my true passion. It's what I want, what I always would have loved to have done if I knew I could. And it's just happened. So I feel like,
well, I'm so happy to sit with you now you're out the other side. I'm sorry you went through all of that, but lovely segue into female founders.
Yeah, in the end.
You're the perfect, you know, guest, of course, for many reasons, to be on the Strategy and Tragedy podcast. But Jesus, it sounds like you really went through the ringer there. So I'm sorry to hear it, but again, glad that you're through it.
I think we all have these struggles, don't we? And I remember at the very, very, very beginning, like when I was first saying to my friend who's a naturopath, like all these things going wrong, she said, something's going to come out of this and it's all going to be worthwhile. And
it's hard to believe it in the moment, isn't it?
It's hard to believe it in the moment. And also that I didn't expect it to be like 18 months of not feeling right and thinking I was getting better and then suddenly something would happen. But like now I'm like, I can see everything that's happened to me has led me to where I am today.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to here where you are today, sat with me and telling me about your amazing story. So Female Founders Rise, I want to congratulate you not only on such a great initiative, we'll hear more about it in just a sec, but also to congratulate you on the fact that my LinkedIn feed, you mentioned LinkedIn before, are absolutely full of other women who are female founders, who are part of the tribe, who are sharing their voices, their stories, and it's all because of you. They're all tagging you. They're all tagging Female Founders Rise. There's this big movement. So big pat on the back, huge kudos for that.
Thank you.
You've grown it to a community of 2,000 members. And I read that you said that the reason why you set it up was because, in your words, as a woman, it's different. What did you mean by that line exactly?
It's really tricky because quite a lot of people ask me that. And actually, I was talking to a female founder yesterday and she said, it's just so different, isn't it, as a female founder? So I think when you're a female founder, you know it's different. There's lots of things. I think, obviously, we know that only 2% of VC funding goes to women. So the funding side is often more difficult. We also often set up different kinds of businesses, so maybe some more purpose-led businesses. But I think what I was trying to say, like, as a woman, it's different, is you do get treated differently. I remember my investors and my board treating me differently. You know, if you're upset about something, it's like, oh,
you're,
you know,
hormonal.
You're hormonal, exactly. You know, you're not really allowed. I remember crying in a board meeting, and then I had a session with this coach, and she was like, you just can't do that. You've got to be nails. If you do that, you're seen as weak. You know,
this is the second time I've heard you say nails. What do you mean by that? You've got to be nails.
Could be like really, like, you know, hardcore, and, you know, and I'm one of those people, it's like, if someone upsets me, even if it's at work, that would make me cry. You know, I've cried quite a lot of time at work. Like, if someone's aggressive or horrible to me, like, I can't be like put on this, like, I don't know, exterior where I don't care, because I do, because, like, my work is a part of me. And something in particular happened which really upset me when I was running my business, and I think I did cry and I just remember then having a session with this woman, and she was like, if you go in like that, they will just totally discount you, which they sort of were a bit, you know, a bit like, oh, you're just a woman, oh, don't worry about Emmy, she's probably just having a bit of a bad day kind of thing, when actually, like, what they'd done was really quite serious and horrible, and it really did upset me. Have I gone off totally off tangent?
Not really, no, like, but you are making me think of the translation of, you know, the same.
Oh, why it's different, you said, why is it different as a woman? Yeah, and then I think also there's the thing, like, a lot of us will go on to have children, and obviously I am a mum of four, so I'm very, since I had my breakdown, my husband has taken on 60 to 70% of the work with the kids, which is amazing. It's like the tables have totally turned. But before, it was like, as a mum, you just do everything. You know, he was off traveling and it would be always like, I would do it. And what I've noticed actually, which is really interesting, is the schools always call me.
Yeah.
So, like, as a mum, you are the one that
first port of call.
You're the first port of call. Yeah, and I'm always the one that they email. I'm like, hang on a minute, I'm co-parenting with my husband. Can you? So I think, and actually just the way that my children are, and I think many children are, is that they turn to their mums often first, because, you know, you might have been with them on, maybe this is going to change, but, like, historically you've had maternity leave, you've been around with them more, the dads have been off at work. I know that's probably going to change with the hybrid working and all of that, but there's definitely that pull. And then obviously, you know, often we do more of the logistical type things. So if you look at the school WhatsApps, it's most of the mums who are on the school WhatsApps doing all the logistics, doing all the organisation. I've actually come off the school WhatsApps and I said to my husband, you can go on. I think he's on it now.
And I bet they applaud him. I bet they think, oh, what a great dad.
But it's interesting. So I made the decision to come off that. And that's like, I know that Axel, my little one, probably doesn't get invited to all the birthday parties because they can't find. So actually sometimes I'm like, you tracked me down. So you obviously want him there, but we're not on that big, like, and I will miss out on things. But also for my own mental well-being, I don't want to be on those WhatsApps. But that's just an example. Like, as a woman, you often, we know the stats show that we're negative, not negatively that sounds, but, you know, we're more likely to care for our elderly parents and the children, and that load falls to us. So of course it's different. And then we do have our hormones, and we do have, you know, the way that we are, we're different.
Yeah.
We're different to men. You know, we're both great. But being a female founder, and also I know there's so much work being done by so many people to change things, but the way that historically we've been treated in the past is not the same. I've sat on advisory boards where I've been totally ignored by other men who just look at me and they just like, I've sold my business. I'm more successful than most of you sat around this table, but you don't actually want to listen to what I've got to say.
So I can really feel the anger rising within me. And I'm having to make, I'm so angry at you, Emmy. How dare you? I'm having to make such an effort with myself to calm it down. I can feel my blood boiling because I'm fully aware of the stats and the situation. And I, of course, completely agree that as a woman, it is very different for many, many different reasons. But for our own mental health and to save, conserve our own energy, I'm going to focus the conversation on how things are changing.
Yeah,
and
there's
focus
so
it
much
back to
change.
Female exactly. founders rise and how things are changing. You mentioned a few statistics there that I will touch on very briefly. So you did mention about less than 2% of UK VC funding that goes to female founders, let alone when we get into the racial side of things as well. A female founders report, female founders forum report that came out in December showed that there was 2.3% in the first half of 2023. And then of course we've got the new legislation with angel investors as well. So you're an angel. So, you know, that we'll get into that too. But, you know, the numbers are bleak and it does look like things are getting worse, dare I say. The numbers are not painting a pretty picture, but you have had a ton of momentum and success with Female Founders Rise. So what are some of the impactful things that you're doing? What are some of the achievements that you've managed to have in the past kind of
I think
year or so?
One of the things that I want to do is try and focus on the positive things that we can do to change. So it's almost like, how can we rally all these women together to come together and work on, and men, rally men as well. I mean, it's great. We've got lots of men who want to support as well. But in terms of like one of the things we're doing, which we've just launched, is a personal branding challenge for women. So we've got 250 women who are basically coming and learning about how to build their personal brand offline and online. So it's offline, be going on podcasts and doing talks and stuff like that. But often before you get the confidence to do that, you need to just start sharing your voice and content online. And even that is very scary. Like, of course, it's scary the first time you do it. So bringing together women to do it together in like a community, in a sort of safe place, that's what we're doing at the moment. That's incredible to see all these women suddenly starting to share their voices and share their passions and their expertise. And through that, they'll find investors and they'll find strategic partners and they'll find clients and they'll find great team members and things like that. So I think it's really, and you know, sometimes I was like looking at the stats and I remember at the beginning, I'd be like, I actually can't change that stat. I literally can't. And then I started thinking, what is the point of me doing this? Because I'm just bashing my head against a brick wall. Then I did speak to a guy and he said, it's a marathon, not a sprint. I spoke to another guy today and he was saying, this is a 30-year thing, you know? Yeah. And I realized like, I actually can't change it. There's like unconscious bias, there's conscious bias, there's not enough female VCs, there's legislations being changed. There's also the fact that, you know, less women historically have set up tech businesses and people want to invest in tech. So we need to get more women into tech, but that's going to take time. We need to go into schools and show girls that they can be successful, you know, role models. Also, women are more likely to build purpose-led businesses because, you know, like me with Female Founders Rise, I'm not hoping to make loads and loads of money. I just want to do something that has touched my heart and is more impactful. So I think it's about trying to focus on the good things. And also, I feel like if we keep telling women they're not going to get funded, it's kind of like...
It's even more off-putting.
Yeah,
then, isn't it?
It's more off-putting. And so this conference that we just did was just really like having women talking about their stories, how they raised 500 grand. One of them literally raised 500 grand while she was having a baby. Like, her baby was really young. And another woman had bootstrapped, and then she'd found an angel collective, and then she'd found family office. So, you know, we all know that it's hard, but being constantly told that is not always helpful. And actually, like, what can we do to actively change it? What annoys me is that some of these policies in place to supposedly change it, I actually don't know how much weight they have. Might get myself in trouble for saying this because I haven't said it publicly yet before. And I might have my facts wrong, so I will wait for the haters to tell me off.
Caveats out the way.
Yeah, caveats out the way. There's something called the Invest in Women Code, yeah? And every year it's celebrated that more and more people are signing up to the Invest in Women Code. But the amount of money going, VC money and money in investment going to women, is barely changing. And when you look at that investing women code, anyone can sign up to it. It's all anonymous data, and it doesn't actually tell you whether these people have invested any women.
If it's actually translating into the cash.
Yeah, it's all like hidden. So it's like anyone can sign up. You might as well just sign up, put on your website, I've signed up to the investing women code. You don't have to do anything about it. You don't even, it's just a tick box. And that, those are the kind of initiatives that really annoy me. And I spoke to this woman from the government, and I was like, first of all, there's not enough women in government supporting female entrepreneurship and entrepreneurship in underrepresented founders. And secondly, what is the point of something that's just totally pointless? It's just a box tick that doesn't mean anything. Yeah. It's not going to make any change. So I don't want to see people ticking a box to say, I'm on the Investing Women Code. I want to see the hard stats. I want to see you proactively coming to my events, which, by the way, we don't see many VCs coming to and investors. And I'm still not sure. And maybe it's because they don't believe that the women at our events are investable. I don't know what it is. Maybe they're too busy. But if everyone's saying they want to invest in more female founders, you have to do a bit of work to, like, go and find them.
Yeah.
Because
you can't just pay lip service.
No.
Yeah.
And so that annoys me. But anyway, I try to stay on the positive, try to showcase, just raise more awareness of female founders. I mean, I think the more female founders that we can see, the more that we can hear about the businesses they're running, the more that we can buy from them, the more that we can support them, the better. And in turn, also prepare them to run long-term profitable sustainable businesses, which is what we're trying to do, so they can understand the different funding options, because VC funding is not for most, is for hardly anyone. But because it's not, because there's confusion, and I was confused and most people are confused, unless you really understand VC funding, you wouldn't understand that it's only for companies that want to be do 100x, do 100 times, otherwise you're going to fail.
Pinch your returns, exactly.
So most people don't want to have that kind of a business.
Yeah.
But we need to educate people about all the different kinds of businesses you can have and the different ways you can get funded, and also help people to build a long-term profitable business, because that's where the financial freedom comes in for women.
Keywords that are directly picked from my very next question, actually. So it's almost like you read my mind. Is I did read about your mission being empowering women to achieve that financial freedom through entrepreneurship. And as you know, we both know, having run our own businesses, it isn't for the faint-hearted. It is incredibly tough. You know, that's one of the purposes of this podcast as well, is exactly that, the education, sharing more stories, because it is overly glamorized. I guess you've kind of already half answered that question, at least anyway, but entrepreneurship being so tough and notoriously risky, why for you is that still the route that you're shining a light on for female founders to achieve financial freedom?
I think for women in general, being a founder is only for a small number of people. It's really hard. You've got to have, it's not for a lot of people. And for some people, working in a big corporate is the right, you know, way, and they can make money and then they can invest in female founders. They can spend their money with female founders. I think for me, what I would love to see is the female founders that are running their business running a long-term, profitable, sustainable business. So that sometimes means you need funding, and sometimes it can be customer-funded, especially if, like us, you were running a service-based business. I think what I've seen for myself is that I have financial freedom, so I can invest in female founders. I have my own bank account. I don't have to ask my partner, like, what I spend my money on. And I hear quite a few people that might be in a situation where they want to leave their partner or change their circumstances or even make an investment, and they don't have that financial freedom. So I think if you can run a long-term, profitable, sustainable business, which, as we said, is not necessarily easy, that does enable more money to go into the hands of women. And also running a business itself is like great sort of business financial knowledge, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm a capitalist Capricorn, so this completely speaks to my heart as well. And I do think that women, in order to be fully empowered, they need to have money. I'm more and more, especially with these interviews I'm doing, more people that I'm speaking to, that's becoming more and more apparent to me, which is again where that anger rises when I do read those reports, and especially with the new legislation on the angel investors as well, which is definitely going to have a drastic impact. But again, I love what you're doing. Let's keep it positive. Stick with the positive. So you're in a position now where you're able to angel invest and you've set up Female Founders Rise. You've successfully had 3 exits. So I want to come on to that sort of chapter in your story as well with your previous businesses and kind of what you learned from each. What I'll just frame before I ask you the question is some interesting research came out recently that showed that the more businesses that a founder had gone through, the higher the likelihood it steadily increases of success when they set up their next business. So, for example, after the first one, the chance of success increases by 10%. After 2 businesses, it's 19%. After 3, it's 27%. All the way up to 10th business, which goes up to like 67%. Like
I must be on that one now.
You're more than you're more than half as likely to have that success. So, with that research as the backdrop to my next question, what lessons have you taken from each exit to improve your chance of success for the next company that you started, given that you are a serial entrepreneur?
Mm. So sort of exited a lot at the same kind of time. So I suppose I can just share my learnings about running a business and also maybe like what I did in the past I'm maybe not going to do again. So I think the biggest learning I've had from the breakdown and from being ill is that my health and well-being is critical to success. And I need to just, that has to be my number one priority with Female Founders Rise. So I never want to grow Female Founders Rise to the point where it's stressful for me. And like, for example, last week before the Google event, I just committed to, I have to do yoga, hot yoga every single day. I took the day off before the event to do loads of, you know, which previously I wouldn't have done. Before I was ill, I basically just pushed myself so hard. I would never have a break. I would like read, I never read fiction. I'd read business books all the time, trying to better myself, even on holiday. I would be listening to podcasts as I was going for a walk, business podcasts. How many business podcasts can I watch? How many webinars can I watch? Like constantly like feeling like I'm not enough and I don't have enough knowledge and never taking that break for myself. And then on top of that, you know, being a mom, trying to do everything else. So I would say my biggest learning, which I feel like a lot of businesses fail because of founder burnout, huge number, because it just all gets too much and it becomes this like noose around your neck. And I think that happens even more so if you take VC funding and angel funding, because you also just have to answer to other people. So what I kind of love about Female Founders Rise, and I want to keep it this way, is if I'm having a shit day, I could just shut my laptop, or I could, you know, go away and I haven't got loads of people breathing down my neck. Because I've been ill, I don't want that again. Yeah. I've had that in the past and I know how it is and I know how all encompassing it is. Mm. And I remember when we were trying to sell our business and we were on holiday and I just couldn't relax, you know, like you're working all the time, then you can't even relax on holiday because you've got a call in saying, oh, well, someone's going to leave the company. And like, actually, if they leave the company, is the business, are they still going to buy us? Mm. And I can still remember it now. It's just like, you never are able to switch off.
Mm.
As a founder, it's incredibly, you'll know this, it's incredibly difficult to switch off.
Mm.
It's your passion. It's always there. It's like, it's all I want to talk about, all I want to do. And I think that sometimes it's just too much. So I'd say that's like a big, massive learning for me, is I have to prioritize my well-being and basically say no to lots of things. And, you know, now I have got to the point, I get so many requests, I have to just sometimes ignore them. And that goes against my like trying to be polite and nice to everyone. I just physically, mentally can't do them. So that, I suppose, that's the mental and physical well-being.
Do you still struggle to say no if you ignore some of those requests? Is it easier for you to simply ignore than to say no?
Well, I've got a trick now that I have a out of office on LinkedIn, which I pay £50 for LinkedIn Premium, and it says, I'm really sorry I'm getting too many messages, which is true. Here's a link to sign up to Female Founders Rise. So if they do want to sign up, they know where to go and I'm helping them. And if they don't and it's something else, I don't feel rude and I'm actually telling them the truth. I cannot answer all these messages. There's just too many. So then I don't feel so rude. But yeah, I think it's that setting of boundaries, isn't it? And we're so driven to succeed and make money and make impact, and we're all, you know, if you're a founder, you've got this big dream and this vision and you want whatever you're doing to come to life and be successful, and we can push ourselves so hard. And just keep pushing and pushing. And even when you're getting those signs, you're pushing yourself. I mean, I remember I was having a lot of signs, flickery eyes all the time. You know, just a lot of things were not right. Obviously, I had long COVID and other things mixed in, but there's a long time.
Eventually, your body will be like...
Your body basically says, this is
enough
now.
Gives you the signals.
This is enough. You have no choice. You're having a year where you can do absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And I feel that happens a lot with founders because we're not taught, are we, like how to look after our well-being and actually... You know, you're so driven, and then you've got these people behind you, like you've got your team who are like, you're responsible for your team, your investors. There's just a lot.
It's so stressful, and I can definitely attest to that being a very clear pattern, because even just on this podcast, it's become a very recurring theme with other founders, other guests. The, you know, health is your wealth, you know, all those cliches, they are cliches for a reason. It's come up time and time again. So as much as we're at a disadvantage because of our gender, I do also recognize that we're both well-spoken, fully abled white women. I do have a fake posh accent, by the way, which is a different story. I'm definitely not upper middle class whatsoever. What are some of the privileges that you recognize that have helped you get to where you are today?
Yeah. And when you just said we're disadvantaged because we're women, I think we also do have advantages, but they're just not necessarily celebrated. I was actually talking to someone the other day who was saying that he feels that companies run by women. Well, we know that companies run by women are actually more likely to be more successful, but he was talking about like the culture of the company and how that's a sign to growth and to doing but like better long-term growth. And if you can measure the culture of the company, and he was saying he really wants to measure the culture of companies run by women because he thinks that it's much stronger and that ultimately that leads to more growth. So, but yes, I have definitely had privileges. I mean, I grew up in an amazing family with my dad, who's a doctor, my mum, who's a nurse. I am one of four siblings. I went to private school for quite some time, even though I was very unhappy and ended up having to leave, and then went to state school and I loved it. But my parents were like, we lived in the middle of nowhere in Herefordshire, and they felt that the biggest thing they could do for us was to put us through private education. So I obviously had that. And I think growing up in a loving family with two parents, we grew up without a television. So we had this very, like, you know, very wholesome. Yeah, you know, like out in the countryside, lots of games, board games, my mum like around, my dad around. You know, obviously, because he sent us to private school, we didn't have loads of disposable cash, but they made that decision to do that. So I think that would be the main thing, that I got an incredible education, very, very loving family, this kind of very sheltered upbringing. And then that enabled me to go to university. And then, you know, you've got the network effect, haven't you? The people that you meet at those private schools, at the university, they then become your network, which inevitably opens doors and helps you on
and
the way
from there.
Yeah.
Amazingly, you're paying it forward now. So I want to try and squeeze in a couple of quick questions towards the end here, because annoyingly, we're running out of time. I knew I would have tons of questions I wouldn't be able
we're
to
just
ask
starting.
You. But I know, it's just kind of warming up. I know, this is why I wish we had a few hours. But paying it forward, to kind of segue onto the angel investing piece very briefly. So you angel invest yourself. What do you typically look for in potential deals? Obviously, you focus on female founders.
Yeah, I only invest in female. So, well, actually, when I sold my business, I did do a 50K investment into a VC fund. I didn't know what a VC fund was at the time. This is what I was saying to you, like, you don't know what you don't know, but I was helping, I was saying thank you to a guy that helped me with something that had happened in my business, and he'd really helped me, and I was like, there's 50K, put that in your fund, thank you. Actually, in that fund, there's always meant to be one fund returner, and it's going to be a female founder of a retail business. I say it's going to be, I hope it is, because we've already had some money because they do the sort of secondary sale. So we've had some money from that. So that's really interesting. I need to start wearing her clothes more, actually.
Are you able to name drop? What's the brand?
Me and M. Do you know Me and M?
Yeah.
So that was just a total coincidence. They invest in her and right at the early stage, and she's now doing really, really well. So we've had like a partial sale, but we're still part of the ongoing. And then I did a couple of angel investments before I was like, I'm going to do angel investing. So what happened was I was reading all the stats about women getting no funding, and I was like, this is just ridiculous, doing my head in. At the same time, I'd been ill and I decided to sell my house, and I thought with the profits that I'd made, so I bought the house in Wales when I sold my business because I wanted to have something to show for all my hard work. That didn't work out because we moved there, and then after that I just wanted to like move on, and I made about 80 or 90k in the selling, buying and selling of the house. So I decided that that profit I would put into Female Founders. I think I've actually spent more than that now because it's just like, I just love it so much. I can't say no to anyone. But I had like a year. So I think I sold it last October.
And what's your investment thesis now? What do you look for?
So I have invested in about 25, 30 founders. I like to do a real diverse mix. But most of the time, it's something that I'm passionate about. So a lot of it would be around health and well-being. One of them is an app for the creative industries, for young people getting into creative industries. And obviously, I used to work in media marketing, so that makes sense. There's a lot in well-being. And then also some of them quite random. Like there's this lady called Yan Nguyen, and it came through one of my angel collectives. And she runs a robotics company, and I know absolutely nothing about robotics. So I was like, okay, I'll just do like a couple of grand. I think I did like 1 or 2 grand because I'm like, through that, I will learn. And also like, I want to see women doing these amazing things. And then I invest in a company called Jude, which is all about in the sort of incontinence market. I mean, I probably describe that totally wrongly, but she's sort of disrupting a whole area of the market that's like never been talked about. And I actually just, again, that came through an angel collective. I literally watched the video and I was like, this woman is incredible. I just actually put £11,111 in, because I often do the...
Was that symbolic?
Yeah, for me. I quite often do the 111s.
Is that the angel thing?
Yeah,
the
numerology? Well, it's not. I think it is that, but I read somewhere when I was really ill... Not really, that's an exaggeration. When I wasn't well, I read this book by Gabby Bernstein, which is called The Universe Has Got Your Back, and she talked about how often she would see like 11, 11 on her phone, and that's a good sign. And maybe I was just not clutching at straws, but I was just like, when I read that, and then when I would see 11, 11, I'd be like, oh, that's a sign, everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
So I was getting these signs that everything is going to be okay. So then it's like a lucky thing. So now I'm almost like, well, if I don't do... I quite often do like 1,111 or 2,222. And then I sometimes feel like if I don't do that, I almost want to do that for the founder.
Yeah, I love it.
Like, I want the founder to be like, to be okay.
I love that little tidbit. And just to pick up on something you mentioned before about even investing a little bit, even just through that education process, just to plug one of the other episodes, which was with Andy Ayim, the founder of Angel Investing School.
Yeah,
he's so amazing.
Brilliant.
So if you're listening, do go and check out that episode as well. But he talks a lot about that. You know, he says, you know, angel investing can be one of the fastest ways to lose money. There are actually more benefits in terms of that education, exposure, everything else. So I just wanted to highlight that additional benefit. Quick penultimate question. I'm going to have to really choose carefully, but I'm very curious, while we're still with the angel investment topic, is do you ever get any negative backlash from the guys at all? Do you ever get any male founders give you a bit of attitude because you won't look at them? Their
it's businesses? Interesting. So I very clearly say that I invest in women, and I still get lots of men contacting me. So they obviously haven't done their research. So that's not great.
I mean, research.
You must,
it's just
do your research.
Your
research. Yeah,
it's not even research.
Most of the time, when I say I only invest in women, they're like, "Oh, that's cool. You know, great. Well done." I think, like, you know, sometimes we'll be like, "Oh, why? Why do you only do that?" Da, da, da. And it's just like, I actually can't be bothered to have a conversation with you. See you later.
So that's good. So that's kind of the worst that you get. It's just kind of
most of the time, I think most guys that are raising investment have got the message that it's easier for white men than it is for underrepresented founders. Mm. So they kind of know.
Hashtag not all men.
Yeah. I'd say most founders are kind of aware of that. So yeah. They don't normally come back, and maybe they do, but they're not saying anything to me.
Yeah, good to hear. All right, final question, which is a tradition on this show. It's called Strategy and Tragedy for a reason, because often the best lessons can come from the biggest mistakes or tragedies. You've kind of touched on this with your wellness, with your health, so you know, maybe that's part of the answer, but what's one big tragedy that's taught you an unforgettable lesson?
Well, let's not talk about the health. We talked about that a lot, I think, and it's not a big tragedy. Like, I mean, it's not a tragedy, but it basically took one of our companies under, which was when we went on Dragon's Den, we had an online comparison site for online gambling, which was the industry that I worked in when I first left uni. Not an industry I love, but, you know, you just get into it. And I didn't know anything about search engine optimization. This was 20 years ago. Everything like digital was like a bit of a dark art. We were at the forefront of digital, but we were learning all the time. And we use a search engine optimization agency, which we paid quite a lot of money to help us. And I found them by basically seeing who was like the best speaker at this event in America. So I was like, right, in America, this guy's talking, he's the keynote speaker, he must be really good. So he was really good, but he was really good at also the dark art of SEO. And at the time, there was a lot of like, no one understood how SEO worked, and especially in the sort of some of the more unregulated industries. I mean, let's say like hardly anyone understood digital. So it was all a bit like Wild Wild West. And basically, to cut a very long story short, we got them to do our SEO. We didn't exactly understand what they're doing. We kind of understood what they're doing. We didn't understand that it wasn't allowed in Google. You know, we knew that it was a bit sort of not great. But everyone was doing it. It was just like, this is what everyone was doing as a Wild Wild West. Anyway, we got reported to Google by someone, by a competitor. And we got penalized in Google, which meant that they reduced our rankings from like number one and number two to like number 50. So basically you just lose all your traffic overnight. So we were running a business, we were hiring people, we were making decisions based on, I think at the time our income was like 20K a month or something. And we lost all that overnight. And the SEO agency were like, don't worry, we can do da-da-da-da and we can change it all around. And they kept telling us they could do things to rectify it after 3 months, still not rectified. So my lesson from that was like, never ever, well, first of all, never rely on one channel. That's, you know, don't just be like, if you're trying to build a growth business and, you know, you can't just be like, I'm only ever going to use email marketing or only ever going to use this. You've got to have a mix because you can't rely on one thing because you only need the algorithm to change or Facebook to suddenly chuck their prices up or whatever. But I think the main thing was is that you've got to have, even though you use experts, you've got to have an understanding of what that expert's doing. And you have to have some understanding of like something that's so critical in your business. You've got to understand it. You can't just be like, there you go, you do it. Because essentially, we lost our whole business because of that.
I'm smiling just because, not obviously, that's horrible news.
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, I didn't really enjoy that business anyway. I was like, I don't want to work. Yeah, it's all good.
But coincidentally, that's actually pretty much the exact same answer that I had on a different interview, which was with Nick Telson-Sillett, the co-founder of Design My Night. Mm. And it was around the same time as well, around 20 years ago. And it was a very, very similar story in terms of Wild Wild West, as you say, yeah. Digital was new, and that over-reliance, not only one single channel, but on an agency being outsourced, not fully clear what was happening. They were doing something which I believe was called like black hat techniques.
Yeah, that's the same thing. Black hat SEO. Yeah, exactly.
So such a coincidence. Yeah. Kind of the same thing has come up again. Emmy, I'm so genuinely sad to say that we are out of time because, as you said, we are kind of just getting warmed up and stuck into it. But thank you so much for coming on show, for making the time in your super busy schedule to come on and share some of your story. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for listening. I really hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please hit that subscribe button if you haven't already, and tune into next time.